This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
In this edition today, our bulletin of church news that will be followed by panorama and then our feature of culture and society. Today we shall close with a segment dedicated to young people. My name is Kanyan Tagodufri Kampamba. Pope Francis on Thursday received in audience another group of bishops from the United States of America Conference of Catholic Bishops who are in Rome for their five-yearly ad limina visit to the Vatican. The 18 bishops received by the Pope belong to the 15th region of the Bishops' Conference of America. The Holy Father will continue to receive more groups from the United States of America through February. There are more than 400 bishops in the Episcopal Conference of the Catholic Bishops of the United States. The Pope on Thursday also met with Monsignor Ramon Alfredo Duce, the Archbishop of Resistencia in Argentina. That encounter came just before the Holy Father received an audience participants at the Plenary Assembly of the Congregation for Catholic Education. Pope Francis, in his address, reminded the group of the importance of education, one of whose properties, he said, is that of being an ecological movement. Lydia O'Kane reports.
Education is a dynamic reality. It is a movement that brings people to light. Those were the words of Pope Francis to participants taking part in the plenary of the Congregation for Catholic Education. Speaking to those gathered in the Vatican on Thursday, the Pope stated that education is a peculiar kind of movement with characteristics that make it a dynamism of growth, oriented to the full development of the person in their individual and social dimension. He went on to say that one aspect of education is that it is an ecological movement.
Una proprietà dell'educazione è quella di essere un movimento ecologico.
This educational movement, Pope Francis underlined, requires, of course, educators capable of resetting the pedagogical itineraries of an ecological ethic so that they may effectively help towards a growth in solidarity, responsibility, and care based on compassion. The Pope went on to describe education as an inclusive movement, an inclusion, he said, that works for the excluded and takes the form of educational actions in favour of refugees, victims of human trafficking, migrants, without any distinction of sex, religion or ethnicity. Inclusion is not a modern invention, he added, but an integral part of the Christian saving message.
Un'inclusione che va verso tutti gli esclusi.
The Pope highlighted that education is a peacemaking movement, a bearer of peace. He also noted that another typical element of education is that it is a team movement. He pointed out, however, that this team movement has long been in crisis for various reasons. With that in mind, Pope Francis told those present that he felt the need to promote a day for the Global Educational Pact to be marked on May 14th next, which will be entrusted to the Congregation for Catholic Education. The Pope described it as an appeal to all those who have political, administrative, religious and educational responsibilities to rebuild the village of education. The aim, he said, was to revive the commitment for and with the younger generations, renewing the passion for a more open and inclusive education, capable of patient listening, constructive dialogue, and mutual understanding. The educational pact, he underlined, needed to be revolutionary. To achieve these goals takes courage, Pope Francis stressed, the courage to put the person at the centre.
Per raggiungere questi obiettivi ci vuole coraggio.
In this broad horizon of education, the Pope encouraged those gathered to continue to make strides in the implementation of the pact for the coming years, in particular in the drafting of a directory and in the establishment of a world observatory. These are all commitments, he concluded, which can contribute effectively to consolidating the pact in the way God taught us by the Word of God. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Pope Francis on Sunday, February 23rd, will travel to the southern Italian city of Bari. The objective of the visit is to address a conference organized by the Italian bishops entitled Mediterranean Frontier of Peace. The meeting will be attended by some schistic Catholic bishops from 19 nations that border the Mediterranean. The aim is to highlight the Mediterranean as a meeting of civilizations and a place where Christianity developed and is therefore a frontier of peace. Hailing from North Africa, Europe, and the Middle East, participants will discuss issues connected to migration, evangelization of young people, unemployment, cultural exchanges, and peacemaking. The Holy Father will conclude his visit to the coastal city of Bari with the celebration of Mass in front of the Basilica of St. Nicholas. This visit to Bari will be the second by Pope Francis, following on the one of July 2018, during which he prayed for peace in the Middle East, together with the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartolomeo I. The Nigerian priest who was abducted by gunmen last week has been freed. Father Nicholas Obo was kidnapped in the southwest region of Nigeria and was freed on Tuesday evening, his diocese reported. Obo's kidnapping is the latest in a series of abductions and killings in Nigeria, which have involved Catholics and other Christians. Earlier this week, suspected Islamist militants in Borno State staged an arson attack which killed 30 people, including a pregnant mother and her baby. 18-year-old seminarian Michael Nadi was killed in late January, weeks after he and three other seminarians were abducted from their seminary in Nigeria. The seminarians kidnapped with Nadi have been released, but one is facing life-threatening injuries. In an interview with Aid to the Church in Need, Archbishop Augustine Obiora Akubeze of Benin City and President of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of Nigeria warned that the current situation in Nigeria reflects an unnecessary, unwarranted, and self-inflicted tension and a politically polarized nation. You are tuned to the Daily Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
The International Organization for Migration has called upon the European Union to ensure the safety of migrants fleeing Libya. The call was made on Wednesday after the port in the Libyan capital Tripoli was attacked by missiles from forces loyal to General Khalifa Haftar. General Haftar's troops have besieged Tripoli for 10 months now. 200 migrants managed to escape by boat after the attack, but were intercepted and returned to the port. The International Organization for Migration has appealed to the Mediterranean countries to share responsibility for welcoming and protecting people who are rescued at sea. At least 1,700 migrants have been intercepted or rescued and returned to Libya this year. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, has called upon the government of Cameroon to investigate the killing of villagers in the English-speaking region last week by suspected government soldiers. Last weekend, the leadership of Cameroon's National Army denied that its troops had participated in the killings. But on Tuesday, it changed its position to suggest that the victims were caught in a crossfire between government troops and separatist rebels of the Ambazonia movement who were fighting for the independence of the English-speaking region. The Transitional Legislative Assembly in South Sudan has passed amendments to the constitution, allowing the country to return to 10 states. This was one of the key demands by the rebels to end the civil conflict. At independence in July 2011, South Sudan had 10 states. But in 2015, President Kiri created new ones until they became 32. Most of the states were created in areas where Kiri's tribe, the Dinka, are a majority. The rebels accused the president of trying to tighten his grip on power by creating unnecessary states. The amendments to the constitution followed an extraordinary meeting of ministers on Monday, which passed a new resolution to replace the 32 states with 10. President Kiri and rebel leader Riek Machar are under pressure from the international community to reach agreement on the formation of a transitional government before Saturday, February 22nd. Mr. Machar arrived in Juba on Monday to begin the process. You are tuned to the English Africa service of Vatican Radio.
This is Culture and Society, and you are welcome to the program. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. At the peak of active conflict in the Nuba Mountains of Sudan, Dr. Tom Katina volunteered to help the Roman Catholic Diocese of El Obeid establish the Mother of Mercy Hospital in 2008. Ever since, Dr. Katina is the only surgeon for the surrounding population of 750,000 people. The catchment area of the hospital covers roughly one-third of South Kordofan. Patients usually travel by foot or hitchhike for up to a week in order to reach the Mother of Mercy Hospital. At any one time, the hospital has between 300 and 450 inpatients. This is the reality surrounding the daily life of the American-born Katina, whose only desire upon graduation from Duke University Medical College only meant one thing: service to the needy in a rural setting. Today, Dr. Tom Katina has become a household name in the Nuba Mountains and beyond, all because of his selfless service to the poor. His Mother of Mercy Hospital has been responsible for the survival of many of the victims of the violent campaigns of Sudan's former dictator, Omar al-Bashir. Katina also concentrates much of his effort on humanitarian affairs and dreams of leaving the Nuba Mountains a better place than he found it. Talking to me in an exclusive interview, Dr. Katina last week spoke about some of the heart-rending experiences of a medical doctor trying to make things work in the dangerous and frustrating Nuba Mountains in southern Sudan. He says that only faith has so far kept everything together in that area. Today in this program, Dr. Tom Katina tells us more about his difficult work in the Nuba Mountains. Are there moments when you have felt maybe frustrated from all these things happening around you, feeling that things are not just adding up and you just want to leave the place and go back to your America, other than risk your own life? And could you cite one moment of your in your life when such a thing happened?
You know, it's funny, Godfrey, I wouldn't say the frustration has come from the fear of losing one's life. It's more from the frustrations of just being in the remote environment, not having what you need to get things done, dealing with the limits of our knowledge. So we have a lot of, the load of patients is very heavy, and you can't possibly know everything. So sometimes you get bad outcomes or a patient dies, and that's heartbreaking, very frustrating. Those are the times I think when I'm like, oh, psychologically, I need a break. Probably the worst moment I had during my entire time, this is even when the hospital was bombed, when we were told we had to leave because we were the local rebel government said that the Sudan Army was going to overrun our position. Those ones were frightening, but we always stayed. The worst moment I had was there was a Sunday morning, and I was doing the rounds. And at the time, we had a measles epidemic. We had 125 children with measles. We had another 100 on the children's ward. And doing that, I was in all the measles children were behind the hospital in tents. We set up 7 tents behind the hospital. And I was back there doing the rounds. I just wanted to do a quick round on the ward before I was going to mess. And I'm there, and then we go into one of the tents, and there's a mother who was just wailing and screaming and rolling herself on the ground. And this is how the people react if a child dies. They just go into this kind of a severe form of mourning. And I went over, and the baby was already dead. And I felt at that point, I felt despondent. I really felt a sense of despair, like we're doing everything we can, and these children are dying from preventable diseases. It was very much a low point. So I walk out, and I'm like, oh gosh, this is a bit too much to handle. But then I think the faith is what always brings me back, because you know, it's, you say, okay, you know, in the end, I'm not the one who's in charge of who lives and dies. I do my best, and all of us as a staff, we do our best. And people die, you know. And if we try to take the place of God and say, no, we're the ones that control this, then we've lost everything. We have to, sometimes we, in humility, we have to accept that sometimes bad things happen. And to be of service, to keep being of service to the next patient who needs our help, we have to just keep moving forward. And I think it's the faith of my faith, of the sisters and our staff, that allows us to keep moving forward, to know that God is with us despite hardship and problems. Mm-hmm. And our role is just to keep moving forward, to stay faithful and to keep taking care of the people there. And that way it's still agonizingly painful, but I would say it's a bit more bearable.
Now, in The Heart of the Nuba, that documentary film, mm-hmm. Dr. Kenneth Carlson says that the Nuba Mountain is calm until it is not. The brutal campaigns of former President Omar al-Bashir at one time was brought close to your shores, as you have also hinted at. Mm-hmm. And the Mary Mother of Mercy Hospital, the only one existing in the middle of nowhere, was bombed. With this violent reality unfolding right in front of you, what was going on through your mind?
I mean, of course, your immediate reaction is one of fear. The first day we were bombed by a Sukhoi 24 jet, which is a Russian make. It's a supersonic jet bomber. And you hear the rush of the jet engines. And then literally a second later, the bomb drops. And that was the first of several bombs that were dropped. And the sound is deafening.
Dropped directly at the hospital.
It was just outside the hospital. But the whole hospital shook, and all the dust and stuff fell onto us. It was so loud, I thought it was like 2 meters away. So we all just fell down on the ground, and we got down. Everybody's yelling and screaming. So what comes to your mind at first is fear, and then it's kind of okay, survival instinct. See, where do you go? So I ran out foolishly, and went out, and eventually jumped down into the foxholes to protect ourselves. We have foxholes that were dug all over the place. For self-protection. We waited there in the plane.
Are they not affected when there is a bomb like that?
If you get in the foxhole down low, usually the bomb will, unless you have a direct hit in the foxhole, then that was your day to go. Mm-hmm. But if the bomb drops nearby and you're down in the foxhole, usually the shrapnel would explode up and out.
Okay.
So if you can get down low, you can avoid being hit with the shrapnel. That's your only hope. And you're just down in the foxhole with the other patients and everybody else, just shivering with fear. And you say, let me just get through this. You just have to get through it. But fear is the overwhelming fear that you have during this time.
Now, long-time autocratic President Omar al-Bashir was forced to step down after 30 years in power.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that currently the situation has improved?
Yes, I for sure. Now there's ceasefire. There's no active fighting. There's a bit of hope that Sudan has a future. There's what's called a transitional government. You've got five, made up of 11 people, five military, five civilian, and one civilian prime minister. The military people are still members of the former regime, and they have a lot of blood on their hands, but there's some hope. I think the people really went out in protest in the north and spoke very loudly, and I think the government is paying attention to what people are saying now. So for the first time in Sudan in 30 years, more than 30 years, there's some hope that we'll have a peaceful resolution to our conflict in Darfur and everywhere else in Sudan.
Now, somewhere in the documentary, the same one we are referring to, The Heart of Nuba, you mentioned that your mom and dad are getting older,
mm-hmm.
and that somehow you miss that sense of closeness. This was then.
You're right.
Would you say the same today? I'm asking, conscious of the fact that you have not just chosen to work and live among the Nuba people, mm-hmm. regardless, but also that you now are one of them.
Yes.
Has the presence of your wife in these recent years changed how you appreciate your work in the Nuba Mountain?
Yeah, I think we married May 6th, 2016. And that was really a positive, great change in my life. It made the work, in a sense, a lot easier to have someone to share the burdens with, mm-hmm. Just to have someone to be with, to talk with at night. The work there can be extremely isolating, and it was just work all the time. And I could have kept going and at that pace, but really it was my wife has really been a godsend to me to have someone to share that life with. There's no doubt.
Is she from the nearby area there?
Yeah, she's from literally the hill right next to the hospitals where she grew up.
So she knows it all.
Yeah, yeah. She's from the area and grew up in war and went to school under the tree and all that kind of stuff. So she's from the local area. Yep.
Would you talk a little bit about your experience as a surgeon, a veteran humanitarian, and of course your 2017 Aurora Prize?
Yeah, you know, I learned those 7 years in Kenya, I learned a ton of surgery, a very steep learning curve, and I was fortunate enough, again, to have mentors, medical mentors, other medical doctors that had been working there for many years, both Kenyan and American and Irish, Swedish, all kinds of different medical doctors I worked with over the years. That taught me a lot. So I think I was able to accrue a lot of surgical skills that, say, if I had trained in this in surgery in the U.S., I wouldn't have gotten. There were skills very much amenable to work in rural Africa. And, you know, the type of surgery there is like, I think, like nowhere else in the world. I mean, whatever hits the door, you've got to try to manage. So a typical day in the operating room, you might go from a pediatric a kid with a hydrocephalus or a large brain, a lot of fluid in the brain. You've got to put a tube in, and maybe the baby is 2 kilos. You go from that case to an adult with a hernia, to a woman who's got cancer of the cervix, you have to do a hysterectomy, maybe to a bone fracture, you have to put an orthopedic plate on it, to an old man who's got a big prostate, and you have to do a prostatectomy. So there's a huge variety of surgical cases, the same in the medical side. But I think I was very well prepared by having the good fortune of working under many mentors during those many years I was in Kenya.
Sudan's Nuba Mountains medical officer, Dr. Tom Katina, talking to me there in an exclusive interview about the challenges he faces as he tries to make things work in the dangerous and frustrating Nuba Mountains in southern Sudan. And that is all we have time for today in this edition of our Culture and Society. Until next week, at the same time, my name is Kanyan Tagodifri Kampamba.
And now, news for young people.
Hello and welcome to the program. I am Festus Tarawali. In this edition, we continue to look at child soldiers, and we shall hear from a former child combatant who was forcibly recruited in Sierra Leone by the Revolutionary United Front rebels during the country's civil war at the age of 7. Kabar Williams was rescued from his captors and reintegrated into his community with the support of the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, and partners in 1994. UN News' Daganit Perez asked him how the experience had changed him and what hope there was for people facing similar situations.
Well, the challenges there is enormous. At this point in time, former child soldiers are facing the most crucial part of their lives, because looking at the terrorism that is going around the world, and it makes it very difficult for governments and other groups to release these children. But I can tell you, if I can go through and succeed to become somebody, then definitely they today have a better thing. Because all they need is like, they need a better place to live. They need an education. They need a mother, somebody that can at least regulate. So it's like, not that former child soldiers, they don't have a place. They have a place in society. If society is willing to forgive and accept us as people, rather than as menace in society. And another thing, our government has to be involved. The government, the community, everyone has to put hands on board.
You mentioned that religion and education were two key aspects to be reintegrated into society and to find a value system in your life. Could you describe maybe a little bit how those two things, religion and education, helped you?
One, education helps me greatly, because the time I was using to concentrate on violent stuff when I was a child, when I was with the armed group, when I found myself in the SOS Children's Village, it's like I don't have that time anymore, because I have to spend the time to solve my English assignment, my math assignment, so I won't have time to think about violence. Important. And the religious aspect is like going to church or going to mosques is just like a counseling, wherein the pastor or the imam will be administering about the good moral things that are acceptable in society and how we should treat ourselves.
So since you were 7 and for many years after that, you were taken away from your home. People tried to convince you to commit acts of violence, right? So they tried to convince you that it was acceptable. And so all of a sudden you found yourself taken away from that milieu and explained that life is sacred and that you shouldn't be violent. How was the transition from one value system to another value system? Was it all at once? Was it gradual?
Well, it was gradual. For instance, the SOS Children's Village played a very significant role, but because for the fact that they have a village and it is strictly being controlled. It's like from school to your home, from home to school. I may have the instinct to like try to beat up the boys that are disturbing me or try to provoke me or try to pull me out. But if I beat them, they will tend to report me. And when I'm reported, definitely they're going to punish me. So I tend to move from that culture of violence to a culture of peace because I find myself in a home wherein I'm treated like any other child in the society. I have a brother, I have a sister, we call ourselves, not biologically, but I have a brother, I have a sister that we can call ourselves brother. And I have a mom, somebody that's placed in the home that can serve as a mother. Those are important, concrete pillars that helps me to really, really move from that culture of violence to the culture of peace.
That was Kaba Williams, an advocate for children's rights and a former child soldier in Sierra Leone. And that's all for this edition of News for Young People. Till the same time next week, I am Festus Tarawali.
This is the Africa Service of Vatican Radio. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.